Are you passionate about our region and its future? Do you want Geelong to be more livable, innovative and resilient? Then connect with Geelong Sustainability, a community group working to create a smarter, fairer, healthier future for Geelong.
The Sustainable Hour.
Geelong Sustainability.
Sponsoring the Pulse.
As always, we'd like to acknowledge the land of the Wathaurong people on which we're working. We'd like to pay tribute to their elders past, present and those to come. And we'd like to acknowledge the great work that One Fire is doing in Geelong for reconciliation.
And today in the Sustainable Hour, we will be talking about connecting to our ancestors and getting all the way back to the time when we were gatherers and hunters and growing food and all that. We will be talking about frugal hedonism. But first of all, today will be a show about power. Power, that's a word that can be interpreted in many ways. Power. Our Power is the name of a new film coming out. And we've talked about that film before, haven't we, Tony?
There was
a crowdfunding, and it was interesting. Was it going to happen? Was he going to be able? That was the director, Peter Jacona, who was asking us to help with this crowdfunding thing. And they succeeded at the time. And today, welcome in the studio to Peter Jacona. You're here with your film under your arm.
Hey, Mick and Tony, thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Tell us how it's been. You know, the crowdfunding at the time, that was about half a year ago. You actually succeeded getting how much? $20,000?
Yeah, we raised $20,000 over the last 2 years. It's been enough to pay the bills and get fed and all that kind of stuff and allow us to go down to the valley about 40 or 50 times in those 2 years. But we've got a film that's almost close to being done. I'd say it's about 90 to 95% there, and we're really excited to start sharing it with
the
community.
Okay, so it's not totally finished yet.
We're pitching it as an advanced screener. So we're in the process of getting a little bit of feedback and notes from the community, and also directors and producers that we know have a little bit more experience. But post-production is very, very expensive. We think we're going to have to raise another 10 to 15 after that to get it coloured, mastered, graded and all that kind of stuff.
To a layperson, such as myself, what does that all mean? What's the post-production? What has to happen?
Okay, so original music has to be written for it, or we purchased music that has been that you can purchase online and all that kind of stuff. At the moment, it's got copyrighted music over the top of it. It's been shot on many different cameras, so we need to bring the colours in and make it look like one uniform kind of film, and then you put a grade on top of it, which gives it a style, and then the whole thing needs to be mixed in terms of the audio, so like the ambient noises you use in the background, the music, the main dialogue and all that kind of stuff. That's kind of beyond us up to this point. We've done the shooting, the editing, the directing, the producing, and now we have a couple of other capable people in mind who, you know, are already giving us mates rates, but we need to pay them as well because they're professionals and
sure,
we want the best out of our product as well.
So, Peter, some of our listeners have been with us all the time. This is our 160th show, by the way.
Congratulations.
But to new listeners who haven't heard about Our Power before, maybe we should just wind back, and we have time to actually hear the full story of how did it all begin? How did this film come about in the first place?
I'm someone that's been very passionate about climate change and sustainability for a very long time. I feel it in my bones for a very long time, since a young kid, basically. And I was at Melbourne University about 2 years ago listening to a gentleman by the name of Bob Massey, who was talking about sustainability in a new way of doing economies and all that kind of stuff. And this was about 12 months on after the 2014 fires of the open cut mine fire of Hazelwood. And there were Latrobe Valley community members who had travelled down to Melbourne to kind of share their story. And I remember there was this lady that hopped up towards the end of Q&A time at the end and just, you could just hear it in their voice. They were desperate for someone to hear their story. We went down there over a weekend thinking that we could cover the whole picture, at least the fire at least, and, you know, that wasn't enough time. And we've just been down there for 2 years now, and there are big picture problems down there in terms of social, economic, political, and also obviously environmental. And it's a really compelling story. It's about the story of where Melbourne gets up to 80% of its power every day from brown coal, which is, you know, it really horrible stuff. We're the only state now that burns it. And I think most communities, including Latrobe Valley, want to step forward and you know, look towards more sustainable ways of developing power and more sustainable ways of having economies, so it's not all dependent on one industry.
it's really a display out there, isn't it? Because there's a road that runs right through one of these big power plants.
Yeah.
And you're sort of almost driving in the smoke.
Yeah.
I experienced that this weekend because we were out there in Gippsland, and coming back to Melbourne, the highway just runs right through a power plant. I've never seen that before, but quite impressive building. You know,
it's amazing. Once, you know, it's a bit of a shock value when you see it for the first time, but, you know, like I said, we've been down there for about 40 or 50 times in those 2 years. You kind of get to love them almost in a way. They are a testimony to man and what we can create. It's just that they're very old technologies. Loy Yang, which is the newest power plant, was built in the 80s. So, you know, that's looking 30, 35 years old at the moment now. So I just think, what can we do these days that a testament to man in terms of creating energy that's not so bad on our environment? Because it is, you know, brown coal is pretty horrible stuff.
And right now, Hazelwood is about to be closed down. We could see the chimneys as we were driving on that road. You can see these very
amazing view,
clear
isn't it?
Chimneys there. There was no smoke coming from them anymore.
I think they've cleaned them up a little bit. Residents tell us when the carbon tax was ditched, a lot more stuff has been coming out of them. And what we've been filming in the last 2 years, we've got gorgeous, quite bittersweet kind of shots of just those 8 chimneys going up with brown coal and just looking disgusting kind of thing. But you can imagine as well when that open cut mine was on fire for 45 days, the amount of ash and soot and toxic gases that were coming out of that pit and spreading all across the Latrobe Valley. It was just horrible.
Mm.
And these people kind of just experience that on a daily basis. And it's definitely Melbourne's sacrifice zone in terms of generating that power.
Yeah, well, they got very little support too from authorities that are there to protect them, and they had all sorts of battles to get information from the government and get, again, it's this, the word emergency being declared.
Yep.
There was a major reluctance to have that, but that's what it was.
Yeah.
And people died.
And they have. Somewhere between 11 and 40 deaths at the moment, and that's kind of what they're still looking into in terms of all the stats. Yeah, they were told to stay inside, but the air's okay to breathe. So it was kind of this mixed messaging, and, you know, they didn't clear Morwell for a couple of weeks, and then eventually Morwell South was cleared a couple of weeks into the fire. Morwell North, you know, Morwell South actually didn't exist during the fire. It was just they divided the town into two, and some people were lucky to go and some people stayed, and it was just horrific. The whole town should have been declared an emergency. Morwell really copped it. And some of the stats and figures now are slowly coming out. And, you know, it was just horrific, you know, in terms of the particle matter. I think it was about 40 times the national UN levels in terms of PM 2.5. And some of these townships experienced that for up to, you know, 20 or 30 days, you know, in a row. So
yeah.
You can't think what it's done to their health, unfortunately.
So the way I understand your film, Our Power, is that it touches on the human aspect. You're talking to the people who live near these coal-fired power plants. But do you also talk about the economy? Because now that Hazelwood is closing, I mean, I'm reading Andrew Bolt writing his column again and again, and he came out with a bunch of lies again this Monday about how, you know, prices on electricity are going to go up, and it's terrible, they're closing Hazelwood, and all these things. Does your film touch on these topics as well?
A little bit. I mean, there's only so much we can cover. We touch upon renewables in terms of how much increased jobs, you know, I think it's 5 to 10 times the amount of jobs that can be created within renewable sectors compared to the coal industry. You know, if you think about it, Hazelwood is closing, but only 1,000 jobs within the valley are going. That means there's only another 2,000 or 3,000 jobs in the valley that's also in coal. So really, that's not a whole lot of jobs, and I think that can be distributed through so many other different industries down there, especially renewables. And the sad thing is, before it was privatised, and that's another big issue we haven't really touched upon, is that the SEC, when it was state-owned, was actually starting to look into solar technology in the early 90s. But of course, when, you know, it was privatised, that was kind of put out. It was the bare essentials that were just, you know, driven, and it was about production, and brown coal was the cheapest thing.
And profit.
This is what can get me a little bit angry in a way, because we're being lied to.
We are.
You know, with the electricity prices. We were told that, oh, we'll make, you know, we'll scrap the carbon tax, and then every family will get $500 back every year. Because of that. In reality, there's this new report out from the Grattan Institute that shows that in the last 10 years, because of the privatization, prices have just gone up, 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 and the profit within the electricity sector is now like, huge compared to the normal retail sector.
I think prices have doubled since the scrap of the carbon tax. So, I could be wrong with that,
so,
but it's quite high.
So it's all about profit.
Yeah,
and we are the fools who think, oh, it's about a carbon tax. No, it's actually about electricity companies that are, you know, shoveling in the money for themselves. I think Miriam Lyons from GetUp said it in a brilliant way. She spoke in ABC the other day in The Drum. And in just 1 minute, I think she nailed it. Here's what she said.
Renewable energy was always falsely blamed for the problems that we've been seeing in our electricity system recently. Now, our system has been screwed by a whole bunch of things. The energy market has been screwed by privatisation, by deregulation, by a handful of companies that have way too much power and take every chance they get to rip off their customers and game the system, by the fact that we've now got, you know, this big bunch of exporters who can get higher prices or make more profits from exporting gas than from selling it to Australians. But above all, what we've got is a system that's been screwed by a decade of policy absolute paralysis, and that's down essentially to the Abbott and Turnbull. I mean, that's down to the fact that we see a complete politicisation of energy policy to you know, a coalition that's kind of letting its energy policy be run by George Christensen and, you know, members of the hard right who are ideologically opposed to renewables. And that's why we're now seeing everyone from business peak bodies to some of Australia's most polluting electricity companies come out and say anything, any kind of plan would be better than what we have.
Said Miriam Lyons in ABC The Drum. She's from GetUp, and I think she really nails it when she talks. You know, I have nothing against politicians like Tony Abbott or Malcolm Turnbull as such, but I have a lot against the way that they have politicized this question of energy, because it is about climate change.
That's
the only reason I'm upset, actually.
We mentioned in our film it needs to be a bipartisan approach in terms of you know, looking after our future generations. And you look at political cycles, and that's one thing that we look in our film, you know, and they are 2 to 4 to 5 years, and we need to be looking 20, 30, 40 years down the track. You know, I'm a 33-year-old dude, and I'm growing up and trying to start a family soon, and I got to think about my kids and future generations as well. And that's, I think, how we should approach communities and societies. You know, politicians need to be managing those people, not managing a market, managing a community.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what they're there for. They're supposed to be there for.
Absolutely.
To do that. And the thing that I keep banging on about this is they've got kids and grandkids as well, and they must never think about them and their future. But it's because of all this, I guess, it's coming to the tipping point. I'm hearing more and more people now saying that we've got to take the politics out. If it remains a political football, this whole issue, energy and being scared about mentioning climate change, whatever, it's not going to get anywhere. Because it's a race to the bottom with that. We know that. So taking the politics out, and it'll be easy for all the politicians then. This is something we have. It's non-political. We both agree that we've got to do something in an emergency manner, and then we can fight about all this other stuff. But this is too important.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. And then, you know, they have that whole talk about Malcolm Turnbull coming out recently and saying, oh, no, we have a new thing. You know, he talks about innovation. So this new thing that he has is called clean coal. You know, we're supposed to now be spending millions and millions of dollars, taxpayers' money, putting into development of clean coal. You know, it's still polluting. What are we talking about?
Well, it's just trying to maintain the dying industry, really. They have no trouble. These industries have come and gone over the years, and they have no trouble letting that happen. But coal has, and fossil fuels generally have got such a huge influence, and they can't let that go. It's not dissimilar to tobacco, but at one stage someone said, what's this costing us? What's this costing us to prop up this industry? And they said, well, it's not. Let's have a look at, do the maths and look at all the deaths, all the hospitalisation, all the disrupted communities, families. And they said, no, well, we've got to get away from this. Now, that took 40 or 50 years of some pretty solid lobbying to get that to happen, and we're going through the same. Yeah. We haven't learned from it.
And at the same time, now we see a whole island. Tesla has just powered up a whole island with batteries and a huge solar system with 70,000 panels. And there's a little video going around on YouTube. It's actually going a bit viral. Everyone is like saying, yes, this is the future. The future has arrived, and so on. Grant Webster, he wrote, meanwhile, in Australia, plans are well underway for 13 new steam engine factories creating hundreds of jobs for steam engine mechanics. A spokesperson for the Liberal government yesterday said, "We are investing taxpayers' money in big corporations because we see a huge future for steam engines. After all, they are very big and powerful."
I like it. That man's, you know, got a sense of humour.
A bit of humour on Facebook. But power. We're talking about power. Tell us a little bit about your hopes for the film. You've put 2 years into this work. What are you hoping, in a way, should come out? What are people supposed to take out of the cinema?
In a way, I mean, this film is kind of being designed for my parents almost in a way. You know, it's an activist film, but I think it's a very mature kind of approach in terms of doing that. And we navigate many, many different topics.
What is it with your parents?
Well, I just think they've been having a closed mind to the whole debate, and I just wanted to open that up and actually show kind of, you know, the human sacrifice in terms of generating that power and what the 2014 fire meant for the Latrobe Valley. But, you know, that leads us very well into the bigger picture and that political, economic, environmental kind of systems that are happening down Latrobe Valley. What I'm hoping for is to actually tour the film to communities that want to connect to the Latrobe Valley. And what I'm hoping for, Victoria, is that we can all step forward together. You know, we need to acknowledge that, you know, Latrobe Valley have been producing power for the last 90 years. Let's acknowledge that. Let's give them the respect they deserve. But themselves included want to step forward into more greener, more sustainable ways of doing things. So let's step forward as a state. So to tell the Latrobe Valley story, Victoria-wide, even Australia-wide, would be a dream come true. At the moment, we're kind of in the process of touring the film to communities around Victoria in hope of getting a little bit more crowdfunding involvement as well. And, you know, it just kind of spread the story out in a very grassroots kind of way.
And you're coming to Torquay this week?
We are, yeah, this Friday night. This Friday night at the National Surf Museum, I think down there, at 7 o'clock at National Surf Museum, we'll be showing the film, which goes for about an hour, and then we'll be having a panel of three or four Latrobe Valley community leaders down there where you can fire questions at them and connect the Surf Coast community to Latrobe Valley. And the film has always been designed to be a starting point for that discussion because there's only so much we can cover and talk about, you know, in an hour and 10 minutes or whatever. And, you know, let's continue that conversation on and let's all step forward together.
That sounds good.
Yes, it does. And it's, I read an article in The Conversation, I think it was, and it featured Our Power, but also featured a film, and we had the filmmaker on last week, The Bentley Effect. Brendan Shoebridge was there, and yeah, you were saying that you haven't met Brendan, but I'm sure that you will, because the two films really complement each other in all sorts of ways, in the way they come from the grassroots and also the content about community fighting back. And yeah, both of the films have given lots of people lots of hope. And I won't be surprised if they end up on the same billings at some stage.
I hope so.
Yeah, because and you're both committed. You're not setting out to make money out of it. You're setting to raise awareness, and both those films are coming from the right place.
And you look at the current climate in terms of that media cycle right now, and, you know, alternative facts and fake news and all that kind of stuff. You know, these films, I think, I said this to you before, have been born out of necessity. You know, there is a community urge to tell these stories right and to spread these messages of community unity to affect policy outcome. Because, you know, at the end of the day, I think it comes back to policy outcome, how we manage our societies. And you mentioned it before, you know, these big fossil fuel corporations have got massive influence on policy outcome. And I think if the community unite, there's absolutely no, you know, you can't argue with the community when we're all united as one.
That's right. And this is really what needs to happen. People need to understand how important that is. I hope everyone listening out there is listening to what you said. You know, when I read Andrew Bolt, he wrote in Herald Sun this Monday, you know, about green scares. And at the same time, he writes, and I quote, "Australia could run out of electricity." What? Australia could run out of electricity? No, Andrew Bolt, that's not going to happen. And he's talking about green scares? What's that? Telling people that we could run out of electricity when we have all these technologies that we can use to create electricity. And it's only a question of will. As Tesla shows brilliantly, when they provide electricity for an entire island there with 70,000 panels and a lot of batteries, and now offering to South Australia that, if you have problems with, you know, the stability of your electricity, we can put some batteries in, and if it doesn't work, we'll give it to you for free.
Yeah,
you know,
amazing.
Powering a whole state. that just shows where we're at with the electricity at this time.
We have so much natural sun and so many currents in the ocean, so much wind. I think we're silly not to harness a lot of that stuff. I think the next thing will be storage as well. But you mentioned battery storage, but that's not the only one. You know, pumped hydro and solar thermal are very viable and becoming very cheap options. The notion of having 24/7 renewables, you know, it's not a myth. It can definitely happen, and it can happen quite quickly. It just needs the will.
Yeah, it's happening.
We have a breaking news here. No, it's actually song news. And he calls it that. A musician from Melbourne, Peter Joseph Head, has written a love song for clean coal. Because he's suggesting that the Prime Minister might use it in his next speech.
Some things in this world that can't be put into words. May no one know what they look like, but you know them when you see them. They're just like clean coal, clean coal. Sometimes you get to dreaming, you can't but help but believing. Oh, sometimes you get a feeling deep, deep down in your soul. That's just like clean coal, clean coal. Some people call it carbon capture. Some people call it geosequestration. But I know, deep in my bones, that it's something so much greater. Oh, I call it clean coal, clean coal, clean coal. Some people say it's a marketing tool, but I don't believe that. No, no, no. It's clean, clean coal. And the Honourable Scott Morrison, he brought a lump of coal right into Parliament, and he said, no, no, don't be afraid of my little black rock bottom baby. It's just clean coal, clean coal. He said, take a look at those curves, at those beautiful black chiseled features. Oh my word, it's enough to drive a politician crazy thinking of clean coal, clean coal, clean coal. People say it's ultra super critical. Oh, but that just means it burns a little hotter than usual. Oh, they've got all kinds of fancy terms. Oh, but I prefer to call it something a little simpler. Oh, I call it clean coal, clean coal. Some people say it's an oxymoron, but it's the future technology I'm relying on. Clean, clean coal. And in the world, there's only 15 plants on paper that can even make it. And of those 15, there's only 2 that actually are making it. And even the energy industry, oh, they don't want to invest in it, no. And even the experts, they think it's strange we're even talking about it, but they don't understand. Clean coal's not something you do with your hands. It's an idea, it's a dream, it's a symbol, it's a theory. Oh, it's a concept, a vibe, a feeling, a way of living. It's an ideology. Clean coal, clean coal, clean coal. It's clean coal, it's like the Easter Bunny, Father Christmas. You just gotta believe in a clean coal. So I wrote this song to call to let it know. Wait, they don't love you like I love you. Oh, someone turn the lights back on. I'll love you till all time is gone. Oh, all you need is coal. Coal is all you need. Coal is all you need. Coal. About the technology that never grew old. It's clean, clean, clean. home.
Connect with Geelong Sustainability, a community group working to create a smarter, fairer, healthier future for Geelong.
The Sustainable Hour.
Geelong Sustainability.
Sponsoring the Pulse.
And one of the big things happening here in Geelong this afternoon is that we have a visit. Annie Razor-Rowland, who we talked to in November when she had just published her new book, The Art of Frugal Hedonism, is coming to Geelong to speak at the Green Drinks this afternoon at Beef's Bar. So there will be talk about frugal hedonism, about how to have more fun and spend less money. I think that's more or less what the recipe is about. And there's another book that I thought we should look a little bit into, now that we have already looked into The Art of Frugal Hedonism. You can hear that interview, by the way, if you go to climatesafety.info. And just write frugal in the search field there and you'll get the show up, and the interview is right there to click on if you want to hear what she had to say when we talked to her in October. I think it's about 15-20 minutes, the interview.
She didn't sound like there was much doom and gloom that day, Mick.
Ah, no,
she was, it was a very happy, one happy woman.
Very positive look towards, you know, how you can actually lower your consumption and have a lot of fun while you're doing it. So if you want some tips on that, and basically, you know, getting into zero waste and health and happiness and these kind of things, then that's what's happening at Beef's Bar this afternoon, 5:30, and it's free entrance. You should have signed up. You can go to geelongsustainability.org.au, but I'm sure they'll welcome you even if you haven't, if it was just something you heard in the Sustainable Hour. You can always say, I heard it in the Sustainable Hour, so can I please, can you find a seat? I think actually it will be full this afternoon, so you better get there early. Now, someone else who's written a book, together with his wife, Matt and Lentil Purbrick, they have written the book Grown and Gathered, which is a really popular book, as I understand.
Yes, they're out of print, but I'm sure if you go onto the site, which you'll hear during the interview, you'll be able to get one. What this impressed me about this couple is they actually have just gone and done it. They haven't said, oh, we're gonna. They've gone out and done it.
Exactly, so. Yeah. So when we talked to them, or actually just to Matt last week, the first thing we asked him was a little bit about his background, because we thought he was a city boy coming from Melbourne, but as it turns out, he actually comes from the countryside. Here's Matt Purbrick.
We both sort of grew up in the country. I grew up out very close to where we live now, and Lentil grew up in sort of the country outside of Cairns. So we had a taste of it growing up, but we've both definitely kind of been drawn into the city, and I've been living in Melbourne for kind of 15 years, done a bit of travelling in between that. Lentil had been living in Brisbane and Cairns and had moved to Melbourne when we met. And I think what shifted for me was, you know, I'd had an office job, I was a graphic designer, I'd been to uni, I'd studied and done all that, and then taken off overseas with what I could save up. And by the time I came back some 17 months later, I just had seen so much and seen people living so simply and so happily with very little that I wanted to kind of integrate that into my life when I returned. And my family had a big property in central Victoria, so I decided to move back to the farm for the first time in, you know, about 15 years basically, and just started carving my way into that kind of life, and I'm trying to again sort of bring those principles into my life and learn how to grow things and learn how to kind of support myself a little bit more directly from the land. And Lentil came along during that, and she was as enthusiastic as I was, and we were sort of inseparable from the day dot. And she was a speech therapist at the time and was working in Melbourne, and then slowly drew her up here into the country, and she was a speech therapist in the country for a while, but that wasn't enough, and she just quit all that and started growing flowers beside me. And it's all kind of grown from there, really. It's just one experience has led to the other, and we've loved every minute of it, so we just wanted to share it with everyone.
Yeah. So it's just your experience has shown that when you're open to new things, all sorts of things happen to you, and they lead to other things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we never intended, certainly to get to this stage where we're educating people about this. It was a very humble intention at the beginning, and we're having a really nice time now returning to that humble intention of doing this for ourselves again. And one thing just led to another. I mean, I just wanted to grow things for myself, and then I learned how to grow, and I had to sustain myself, you know, financially. So I began to grow commercially, and when Lentil came along, we started doing that more and more. And it kind of expanded from there, and we just continued to check ourselves and have a think about how we wanted to be doing things and what we wanted to be doing and what we wanted to be spending our time doing. And slowly it evolved from there into education, and people were keen on that, and we ran workshops, and we started supplying veggies direct to people rather than going through middlemen. And it just became a sort of process of us knowing what we wanted to do and knowing who we wanted to interact with. And we just wanted a more simpler, natural, kind of more human life. And everything kind of grew from there and just expanded, and we've had experiences we never expected. So it's been a beautiful, beautiful few years.
Now, you've coined the term closed-loop farming. Do you want to tell us, listeners, a little bit about that?
What we do, especially like when you're growing things in the country, and as you scale it up to the more commercial sort of quantities that we were, farming and agriculture in general has this great dilemma of pulling things out of the land in great numbers and taking that stuff away to market these days. And for us, we always have this dilemma of how do we return that fertility without relying on chemicals and fertilizers, for one, but also without having to bring in kind of organic matter from far away. And slowly, we're trying to simplify that process. And where we ended up was this wonderful situation where we'd deliver, it could be, half a ton of vegetables down to Melbourne every week, and we might come back then with at least half a ton of veggie scraps. And then all those scraps, and not just veggie scraps, but it's just food waste in general, which is a very hard thing to get rid of in the city, as you guys probably know. And so all the restaurants and customers would bring their food scraps to us, and we'd bring them back to the farm. We had an empty van anyway. Yeah. So we just filled the van up with the food scraps, took it home, and put it on their compost pile. So what happened was all the fertility that left came back in equal amounts every week, which meant without thinking about it, we always had enough fertility we knew in our compost pile to divide evenly amongst the beds each year. And everything was sort of maintained. So it was just a beautiful process of being able to continually and sustainably farm one spot. And we always sort of brought back more as well. So we were kind of building the fertility on that site without really thinking about it. And it was a very natural, beautiful thing that happened.
Yep. Look, you managed to solve several problems by having the soil improvement with your backload of food waste, mainly from your restaurants that you're supplying.
Yep.
But really what I'm interested in is you've... your customers, your regular customers, the at home. So how have you engaged them to return the food waste to you when they get the next lot of vegetables?
Well, I mean, it was a simple process of we got to have conversations with our customers every week. We had a very, at the peak of the business, so this is all toned down now as we've sort of gone into the book and then education more, but we were delivering at least 60 boxes of veggies every week. So we had 60 families, you'd say, that were coming to collect their vegetables, and every one of them had to come and collect it in person. There was maybe half a dozen or a dozen that we might drop at a shop at one of our friends' cafes for them to collect later. But generally they came and we got to have a conversation. That was the beauty of it. Everyone loved catching up with us, finding out what was going on the farm. We loved catching up with them and finding out what they liked, what they didn't like. And so when we decided to collect their waste and to use that on the farm, it was just a conversation. And of course it was a great idea, and everyone understood that that stuff shouldn't be rotting in landfill. So it was a no-brainer. They came, collected their box, they brought along their compost bin, they emptied into our bins, and off they went. And so it was just a very seamless process. And now this is also in the book about how to create your own worm farm, basically your own composting system at home, so that everyone, no matter what space you've got, you can really be collecting that fertility yourself and feeding it back into your garden.
Yeah, even in the city.
Everyone should be farmers. We think it should be very practical for everyone. Even if you're in an apartment, it gets difficult, but now we've got whole worm farms set up in the basements of apartments that are doing really great things too. So we're getting on top of this problem.
Worm farms indoor?
Indoor, like... yeah.
Yes.
Yep. They're setting up banks and banks and banks of worm farms in some of the most sustainable apartments in Melbourne and throughout Australia now, which is a fantastic thing. And then they're using them on their rooftop gardens.
So where's the gathering coming into the picture? Like, the title of your book is Grown and Gathered. Gathered, what's gathered? Is this food scrap you're gathering, or what's...
Well, basically, our business, we coined Grown and Gathered when we started to deal more with people, and we really created, I guess, a philosophy behind what we did. So we established the business as Grown and Gathered, and the meanings were, manyfold within that. So it was about growing, obviously, produce and flowers. But it was also about growing as people as we were doing what we were doing. And the gathering was about foraging, and it was about seeing what wild foods were around you, hunting and gathering. But as well, it was about gathering together and joining.
Ah, I get it.
And everything else.
So double meaning here.
The book's about that. It's about all of those things. It's about the growing, it's about the foraging. There's a whole chapter on foraging wild foods and hunting wild game. And then it's about coming together and enjoying those things.
Yeah, Matt, maybe we could move on to one of my favourite topics, food security.
Yep.
You seem to be getting some very good yields out of the size of the land that you've got, initially anyway. Maybe you could just give us a few figures about the, you know, tomatoes and cucumbers that you're getting.
Yep. Well, the main things we documented were the obvious ones that we just keep track of. We pick a few, and the main thing with tomatoes and things like cucumbers that were so easy to keep track of. And we've got to bear in mind that they're some of the highest yielding, I guess, veggie plants that you can have. But certainly once the, when we're in peak season and running, we'd run 60 metre rows. So that was about, it was a bit over 60 plants. They were spaced 90 centimetres apart. And every week we'd be pulling out over 100 kilos of tomatoes from each of those rows for about 12 weeks. And then, so that's in the space of 60 metres squared. And then for the cucumbers, it was even more. They were up at about 140 thereabouts for a 60 metre row. So extraordinary yields in that space. For vertically trellised vegetables. So it was about having a small space, very intensively working it, and we had, you know, a team of, there was Lentil and myself, we usually had at least four kind of staff/interns doing what they do. And so, you know, it was very intensive weeding, mulching, and just sort of maintaining things. And you could do it a lot wilder and a lot more spaced out, but we just wanted to see what we could pull out of this small space. And it's irrigated as well. So, you know, the process we were using was about how do we use the least water possible but make sure our plants get the most efficient water they can get. And we managed to reduce our water use by about 80% by just watering during the day, which no one thinks you should do. But we just had pulse irrigation on drip lines and just gave them a little bit of water, all the plants, exactly what they needed when they needed it. And then we made sure we mulched down to sort of bring that, make sure that water stayed in. And we always tried to build things vertically if we could for the tomatoes, for the cucumbers. And we just tried to maximize yields in that small space and realized we could. And it's for backyards, it's a really important lesson to learn how much kind of food you can pull out of those small spaces.
Yeah, that's just amazing. So many hundreds of kilos every week for weeks and weeks. And with drops of water, you're saying, could you say the figures again? So you reduced your water use with 80%, you said?
Yeah, so we got it down by about 80%. So we're using 20% of the water we were using when we started traditional method, which would be water very deeply for many hours overnight. And what we learned from a dahlia grower up in Winkie, which is up near the border with South Australia, he had a dahlia farm in the middle of the desert, effectively. You know, they get 50-degree days, wasn't uncommon. And these plants were just, you know, living the dream with their leaves out and happy. And he taught us that just to give little bursts all the time to create a little moisture zone right in the roots where they need it. And not worrying about, you know, trying to extend their roots and make them drought tolerant, because in the end, the more you stress a plant, the more water it needs ultimately to do what it does. And so for us, to keep our plants living like kings, we just always gave them that little bit of water, and they always grew their best, and they were strong, and they were ready. If the water actually went off for some reason, if the pumps went out on a hot day or whatever, they were really robust, and they could handle those hot days with no water then, because they were so stress-free leading up to it. They were so strong.
You are actually doing the right things. When we talk a lot in this program about climate change and what we all need to do and so on, and people see it as we're coming with all these constraints and, you know, and we have to limit ourselves and so on. But you speak of happiness, and the things that you have done has actually given you something in terms of quality of life.
I think one of the things with climate change is definitely the climate's been doing weird things. I mean, we were just up north in Bellingen, and New South Wales experienced their hottest summer that they've ever had. We were in Bellingen in 48 degrees, and it was just exceptionally hot, nothing like we've ever seen before. And at the same time, we're having, you know, quite a cool summer down here where we are on the farm. So everything's a bit weird, but you'll never talk to a farmer that doesn't tell you that you just got to work with what the weather gives you. And it's always been, there's been a pattern, but it's always been different every year. And you just got to respond to that, and it's about knowing your plant and then just giving them what they need. It's like having a pet dog, you know, it's about knowing what they need. In the heat, in the cold, when it's dry, when it's wet. It's just about, you know, being a little bit responsive and involved with whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
And it's a fun thing to do. It's in us, you know. It's a very rewarding, beautiful thing to work with nature because it's what we are.
I think when you talk about this closed-loop farming and things, you're also closing another loop, or at least making a circle, because you are actually looking to your ancestors for inspiration by what you do there is something that goes so far back in our history.
Yeah, deeply. And I think we're getting, as we sort of have left the farm and left that very rooted position and moved around a bit more, we've felt almost an even deeper part of us wake up, that moving part of us. And I think a lot of, certainly us white fellas, we forget how we have that legacy too. We have that hunting-gathering legacy, and we forget that that's integral to us as well. And we touch on it in the book, and how kind of impossible it is for us all, obviously, to go out and hunt all the time and gather all the time. But we've realized how important it is to have that element in your life and have that element of going out fishing or going out hunting or going out and gathering wild mushrooms or going out and gathering wild fruit, or at least gleaning it, which I think the Frugal book talks about a lot, going and gleaning fruit or gleaning, you know, your urban forest. And that process of going out in the search for food is a really beautiful thing. And we're really enjoying that, and we're really enjoying kind of going even further back into our ancestry and looking that far back and sort of feeling how that wakes up that part of you. And that's a beautiful experience. We really encourage people to explore more and more, that we almost wish we'd touched on more in the book now that we've been having these experiences more recently. So, yeah, definitely closing the loop with our ancestry is something, and kind of maintaining that wisdom, a lot of wisdom that's being lost, has been a very important thing for us.
Now, one of the things that I'm always on about is what I used to call carbon miles. But on your occasion, I like your term, faraway products. I just love that. Can you just give us a little brief description about that, your 95% and your 5% as well, if you cover something like that?
Yeah, well, for us, I mean, we, like everyone, we like the luxury things. We like our coffee in the morning. We like having chocolate and, you know, the most basic things in our culture, like tea. When you actually start analysing these things, you realise how far away, certainly for us in a temperate climate, how far away they come from. And so there was a part of us initially when we really got a bit hardcore on this whole eating locally and eating what we were growing and eating what the friends around us were growing, which was plentiful, we realised that, oh, maybe we don't need this stuff in our life. But kind of came to the conclusion that life was better with a little bit of coffee and better with a little bit of chocolate and better with a little bit of tea. And so just decided to put that in its place in our diet. And so kind of very consciously called them 5% foods, where 95% of your diet is completely regional, you know, from within however many kilometres you want to sort of set yourself, but you don't even think about it that way. You just think about your regional temperate products that are in season. And then you have these other foods that come from far away. And just allowing them to stay in your diet is so positive in so many ways, in that you know it's only 5%, so you can spend a little bit more money on getting the best quality that's supporting the best farmers doing the best things wherever these faraway lands are. And you try and get as close to those people as possible, even though, of course, you can't get right up to them. We try and always find someone who knows them. So we have good friends who are wonderful coffee importers and roasters who go over to all these countries, and they meet the farmers, and they make sure they're legit, they're doing what they should be doing, and they pay them directly, and they support them in that way. And so we can then pay the extra bit of money that it takes to obviously support that kind of relationship. And we know where that food's come from, and we know that it's a good quality product. And so it's just about realizing and recognizing that all these things like chocolate that seem so ubiquitous in our culture really aren't ubiquitous to us locally, unless you live up in the tropics of, you know, Queensland or something like that. We're just not growing these things here. So once you sort of think about them and reflect on them and put them in their place, you don't feel like you're missing out, and you get the best of the best, and everyone kind of wins. So it's just being aware of all these things in our diet and just being aware of the impact they have if we don't think about them.
Can we, have you got a presence online, Matt, that we
do? We've got our website, grownandgathered.com.au.
Okay.
And people can buy the book online. We've got the books sold out at the moment.
Oh, really?
Very, very widely available in.
Congratulations in a way with that.
Thank you. Yeah. So we've got more coming through. I think in March there'll be a new shipment that'll drop.
I'm getting the first one.
The store. You can get the first one. Oh, we actually have more. We got copies at the moment because we sort of stockpiled a bit for our shop so that people wouldn't get disappointed. So you can order online at the moment, and still there's a lot of stock in bookstores still. Hmm. And so yeah, it's going really well. We feel really lucky to be so supported with it at the moment. The fact that it's been so well supported already is just a real treat for us.
Connect with Geelong Sustainability, a community group working to create a smarter, fairer, healthier future for Geelong.
The Sustainable Hour.
Geelong Sustainability.
Sponsoring The Pulse.
So this was a good long talk with the co-author of the book Grown and Gathered, Matt Purbrick. In the studio, we're talking about power, our power, and we've talked a lot about what's happening in the valley, La Trobe Valley, and in a way, I think it relates to what's happening here. We don't have power stations. Actually, we did in Anglesey. We had one. That closed down, was it a year ago or two years ago?
Yeah.
But we have all these industries that have been relying on fossil fuels. We still have the big refinery out there on the other side of the waters here. We can see that flame burning all the time. But we have also, you know, that sort of transition where people get fired. Lots of people from Alcoa, lots of people from Ford and so on. So Geelong is in a way in a similar position as what you talk about, Peter.
Yeah, I just see it as social structures. You know, you've got, in the valley, it's only one or maybe two industries. You know, you've got the coal industry, which is the massive big one, and then you've got the APM, which is the paper industry out there. Similar to you guys, you know, you've got industries that are in transitions or dying, unfortunately, and which have fed thousands upon thousands of jobs, and it's about, I guess, redistributing that through the economy, through social structures and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, Geelong's a great audience that we'd love to connect with. I think that would really, you know, feel, you know, it'd really hit the spot, I think, with the Geelong audiences, what's happening in La Trobe Valley. So hopefully in a few months' time as well, we'll come back down and do a showing in Geelong with Geelong Sustainability. And, yeah, I think it's a great story you can connect with.
Exactly. And to listeners who've come in lately, we should also mention that you can meet Geelong Sustainability this afternoon at Beef's Bar, where there will be talks about, certainly about sustainability, the art of frugal hedonism at Beef's Bar at 5:30. Also, I wanted to mention that, speaking of, you know, the transition that we need to get started on, there is an electric vehicles conference coming up in Geelong. Did you know that? Isn't that interesting? And this is for the general public. It's for businesses, it's for, you know, G21 local government authorities, for Deakin University, researchers, engineers. Everyone is invited to, I think, the first conference ever held here in Geelong about electric vehicles. That's taking place on the 29th of March, and you got to sign up before the 22nd of March. We'll put a link out on our Facebook page. I think that's the easiest way to say it.
Yeah, sure.
And you'll also find it in a couple of days if you go to climatesafety.info, which is our blog where we put all the podcasts up and where you'll find this program as well. If something you heard in the show is something you'd like to share and somebody else to hear, then you can always find us either on climatesafety.info or you can go to iTunes, the Apple place where you find music. You can also find podcasts there. So if you go under podcasts, look for the Sustainable Hour. You can subscribe. You can download it to your phone so you can listen to it in your car while you're sitting driving 1 hour to Melbourne. It fits perfectly. You know, 1 hour with Sustainable Hour and bang, there you are in Melbourne.
Before you know it.
Before you know it.
Heading over Westgate Bridge.
Exactly. But speaking of the calendar, next week on Monday is actually the International Happiness Day. Something to look forward to, a day where the United Nations has decided we should all be focusing on happiness. And there is that sort of connection between sustainability and happiness. We've talked a lot about that in the show here. People who are living more sustainably are also happier. This is actually a research fact.
Yeah, well, I think Matt, who we just listened to, is a classic example of that.
Exactly. On Tuesday, the day after, there's a decluttering mindfully workshop where you can learn about that. But actually, you can't sign up for that event. It's sold out. And there's even two of them decluttering events, and they're both sold out.
Yeah, that's so another Geelong Sustainability Initiative.
That's right, called Life Learning, which is a great initiative.
It is. So how are those sessions being organised? Is someone from the committee doing that?
Exactly.
Okay.
The initiative came from Noreen in the committee, and she's been driving it. She has people helping her now, and it's fantastic to see that people are so interested and events are sold out. Or it's not events, it's more like workshops. You know, it's places you go to learn a little bit about life.
We'll have to get her
and
on.
And decluttering is certainly something that we should, you know, we can all learn something. I can certainly learn something there.
So is Noreen actually taking, running running the
event? No, she's not teaching. She has teachers who come in and are experts in the field. And that's the same case on the decluttering aspect. Hopefully more workshops will come. So, you know, if it's sold out, it's just a question of making more workshops.
Exactly.
Next Wednesday will be interesting. That's the World Water Day. And we have a water expert in the studio. You can look forward to that. Next weekend after that is the Earth Hour, you know, where people shut the lights for an hour around the whole globe. That's on the 25th of March. So lots of things to look forward to. And I also think we should mention here, just as the Sustainable Hour is running out, that the survey that the municipality is running called Our Future, Time to Decide, where you can select 6 ideas that you believe should be the top priorities for our city, that survey is still running. So you really got to go in on geelongaustralia.com.au/ourfuture and then fill out this quick survey. It doesn't take more than a minute to do. If you put in your email address, you can also win an iPad, or you can win some $50 Bunnings vouchers. It's important that we all speak up now about what we see is our priority for our future here in Geelong.
I've got to admit, at the start I was really cynical about this process, but I've changed my mind about that. It seems like they are listening to the people, and I guess if you don't contribute to this survey that they're running, well, you've got really nothing to complain about.
Exactly. So, rounding off, thank you, Peter, for coming and telling us about the film. Is there any last things? Is there a website where people who are really keen on finding out more can go and things like that?
Yeah. And supporting too?
Absolutely.
Got some dollars?
Ourpowerdoco.com. And as we mentioned before, we'll be in Torquay, hosted by the Surf Coast Energy Group down there on Friday night at 7 o'clock. I think there's a couple of seats left. And you're just saying, you know, you want to see a story of the power of the people, you know, come on down and see that story. There'll be the Latrobe Valley people there. And that website, again, ourpowerdoco.com. Send us an email and click on that donate button if you can.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that discussion afterward is for films like yours is so important that people don't go. They kind of debrief after it and get leave with an idea of what they can do.
Absolutely, I think it's half the experience.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's funny, it seems to me like that every Sustainable Hour we do is in some way or the other ends with the word together. That this is really something we need to do together.
It's a moment for it, I think.
You know?
Yeah.
So at the same time as we always end with this Gandhi quote about what we need to do ourselves, it's also really about getting together. And that's what's happening in Torquay on Friday night, and it's also happening here in Geelong this afternoon at 5:30. So how good is that? I think that's about it. Ending on a very good note. What do you say, Tony?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Peter, for coming in.
Thanks, guys.
Terrific.
Thanks, Mick and Tony. Thank you very much.
Yeah. That's all we could fit into this Sustainable Hour for you. The last thing we need to remind you is that, what do you say, Tony?
Just be the change.
This is the news on 94.7 The Pulse.